Hello, this is the Game Podcast from The Times, and I'm Natalie Sawyer. Joining Gregor Robertson and I today, it is Jonathan Northcroft. Jonathan, how are you doing?
Hi, Nat. I'm good, thanks. I'm basking in the glow of some football last night. It already feels a little bit different from a writer's point of view, and just from a human point of view, it was just really nice watching games yesterday and all the stuff we love, the controversy, the skills and all the rest of it. Things are good.
Things are good, and we'll talk about those two games in just a moment. But I believe you're going to be going to your first live game since obviously this restart this weekend.
I am, yeah. I'm at Brighton v Arsenal this weekend. I'm really looking forward to it. It'll be different from a kind of logistics point of view. I'm really looking forward to actually driving to a stadium without any traffic and parking right outside. that'll be interesting. And I'm kind of, I think it's a challenge for match reporters, actually. I'm not quite sure how we go with it. It'll be a bit of a test sort of finding out. I thought the guys in all the papers did well this morning, but you know, a lot of them were writing about the atmosphere and the setting, and I guess come Saturday everyone will know that these are in empty stadiums and we'll have to not write about that. So I'm kind of quite enjoying thinking through those problems and how we're going to put it all in print when we in Sunday's paper.
And just quickly before I say hello to Gregor, of course, has there been any sort of guidance on protocol? Do you have to arrive earlier, anything like that that's different?
Yes. I mean, it's being recommended that we try and get into the grounds about an hour before, although they're not opening. They're opening 90 minutes before. So you can't arrive too early. But I think the idea is to try and not come in too late. I've just filled in my my forms, which is a kind of health questionnaire that I have to bring to Brighton. And then we'll be tested for temperature at the gates. And the other thing I've been told us to make sure all your stuff's fully charged because there might not be PowerPoints. I think you could see the journalists sitting in the stands and not in a press box from the TV pictures last night. And so there's all those little things that you've got to sort of bear in mind.
Oh, goodness. It's all very different, isn't it? Gregor, how are you?
I'm very well, thanks, Nat. Yes. Yeah, and the same. I was kind of delighted to be opening a newspaper this morning and listen to the radio, the airwaves, and hearing some talk about actual football and looking forward to speaking about it as well. It wasn't quiet, was it?
No, it certainly wasn't. What have you been up to today? I think you've been at a club, haven't you?
Yes, I visited Loftus Road, QPR Stadium today and interviewed Lee Hoos, the chief executive there, just to kind of see how a championship club is also, obviously the championship starts this weekend as well, and just to see how they've prepared for the restart and all the kind of, you have to remember that some championship stadiums aren't quite the same as the Premier League stadiums in that QPR is an old traditional ground sort of hemmed in, and they've had to build new dressing rooms, a kind of porter cabin. They've had to use a lounge for the away team to change in. There's a kind of one-way system because the corridors are so narrow. So we're just kind of having a look at seeing all the logistical things there, and also how the championship is going to be impacted financially, because it's obviously a different world outside the Premier League.
Yeah, sounds all very fascinating. Are you going to be at QPR this Saturday then?
No, I'm going to be at Craven Cottage. Watch your lot.
Oh my gosh, the fear that just runs through me as soon as you mention that. Anyway, we're not here to talk about that game. Coming up, David Luiz goes under the spotlight, but there's only one place to start. After 3 months without Premier League football, we have our first controversy to get stuck into.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
It didn't take long, 42 minutes to be precise, for the first big talking point of the restarted Premier League, and it involved technology. At Villa Park, Sheffield United win a free kick, which is swung in by Ollie Norwood towards goal and gathered by a backpedalling Orjan Nyland. Nyland falls backwards against the post and appears to carry the ball into the goal, but referee Michael Oliver signals no goal as he hasn't received a signal from his watch, triggered by Hawkeye's goal line technology. TV pictures showed the ball clearly went over the line, but there was no overrule from VAR, and Michael Oliver did not use the pitch side monitor for another look. Hawkeye have since issued a statement. The seven cameras located in the stands around the goal were significantly occluded by the goalkeeper, defender and goalpost. This level of occlusion has never been seen before in over 9,000 matches that the Hawkeye goal line technology system has been in operation. The system was tested and proved functional prior to the start of the match in accordance with the IFAB laws of the game and confirmed as working by the match officials. The system has remained functional throughout. Hawkeye unreservedly apologises to the Premier League, Sheffield United and everyone affected by this incident. So as we've said, didn't take long for there to be some controversy in our first game back. Gregor, we didn't want to be talking about technology so soon into the restart. And this time it's not VAR primarily at fault, but who is to blame on this one?
I mean, it's very hard to say. I think it'd be hard to blame any human being. I think the VAR, I mean, the only person you could possibly say was at fault in any way, that a human being, was the video assistant referee, because you'd think it was incumbent upon them to check any goal. But as we've heard, you know, I've heard spoken about since 9,000 games, and this has never happened before, and this was always the one thing, goal line technology, that was almost taken as gospel and that was, you know, infallible, and obviously we now know it's not. So it's going to be interesting to see how that changes sort of perceptions of these rulings, and whether, you know, I'm sure now VAR is going to even when Hawkeye's involved. But I don't think, you know, I definitely can't blame anyone on the pitch. I mean, I remember having watched goals, well, what I thought were goals in the past, and, you know, then you see the Hawkeye footage, and the, you know, there's a millimeter or something. You were certain it was a goal at the time. I know this was different. He was basically lying in the side netting with the ball in his hands. It was ridiculous, but I still think that the psychology of it, the fact that this is one thing, one aspect of technology we thought was perfect. That would do strange things to the referee and to the linesman. And so I really think, beyond looking at the video assistant referee and whether they should have double-checked it, whether that was in the protocols, I don't think you can blame anyone.
Okay, so you're saying that you can't blame anyone on the pitch. What about you, Jonathan? Do you think Michael Oliver could have done more?
I didn't blame Michael Oliver. I think... If I had a question mark, it would be about the VAR referee, I think, who was Paul Tierney, because it does seem illogical, even if Hawkeye did malfunction, or it was this you know, sort of 1 in 9 million chance or whatever, that the ball was at that particular point in the goal mouth, and that meant that the cameras were occluded, which I have a bit of cynicism about, I have to say. It didn't seem that obscure, but let's just take that on trust. Even if it was a malfunction, the VAR referee can see what everybody else could plainly see watching on TV, which was that the ball had crossed the line. So why there is no message to Michael Oliver to at least go and check it, I don't know. And I thought Mark Clattenburg made a good comment in a newspaper today, where he just worries that technology's taken away a little bit of the initiative, the idea of taking responsibility from referees. And it does seem to me that Some of them, and I don't think Michael Oliver's one, by the way, but I think some of them do seem to have fallen into a pattern of relying on the technology instead of putting the hands up and making decisions themselves. I sympathise for referees, all the stuff that's been thrown at them with VAR this year, the way that it's changed in its emphasis almost on a weekly basis. I think it must be a really difficult time to be a referee because it's all in its infancy. But that was a really, really clear scenario that clearly crossed the line. You could see it in real time. You didn't even need a replay. So why the VAR can't put a message through to Michael Oliver, I don't know. I don't want to blame, but I have to ask a question about what Paul Tierney was thinking.
Well, that is it. It's interesting, that point that you've raised from Mark Clattenburg about the reliance on technology and perhaps some referees thinking, or we have the fail-safe, we have something to fall back on if we don't make the right decisions in that moment. But, Gregor, if there was ever a moment for VAR to win over the dissenters, this was it, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, that's absolutely... I think Johnny's hit the nail on the head there. It's only Paul Tierney who could have done anything about it. I don't think anyone on the pitch, as I said, because of, as Johnny says, it almost takes away the responsibility of making that final decision by having the watch on his wrist. And if that's malfunctioned, then I'm with Johnny there. I think there's going to be question marks about that, and I wouldn't be surprised if that kind of rumbles on for a little while. Beyond that, then it was down to the VAR. But as I said, it's never happened before, so I have some sympathy. But you just wonder how long it was. You know, how long after the goal had happened that Paul Tierney became aware that it was a goal and a clear goal, and whether that would have been a moment where he's just kind of frozen and thinking, we don't know how far is, whether it was a minute afterwards or 2 minutes afterwards, or he would have happened, that moment would have come, and he's not made contact and not done anything about it. So yes, it's going to be very interesting to see the fallout from this.
You know, Sheffield United could be excluded from the Champions League because of this. They're in such a tight race where it will come down to very, very fine margins. And maybe for the rest of us, there's a slightly comical aspect of, football takes all this time to get going again. And when it gets going, there's a sort of VAR error. And that's so typical of the season. But for Sheffield United, this is deeply serious. And if they end up missing out on what would be an unprecedented historic achievement in their club's history, a game changer for their club because of this, it's just incredibly, it's incredibly sad. It'd be like Ireland missing out on that World Cup, really. I mean, and I could see, you could see Chris Wilder's frustration and completely understand it last night.
It, of course, is not the first time that Villa have been involved in a controversial goal. Who can forget last year's championship clash at Leeds? Villa's Jonathan Codger went down injured and Villa stopped playing as Leeds' Tyler Roberts slowed down as if to kick the ball out, only then to run through and set up Matthias Klick to score. The Leeds boss, Marcelo Bielsa, then ordered his team to allow Villa to score, which won then the 2019 FIFA Fair Play Award. Now, maybe I'm living in dreamland, Gregor, but do you think Villa should have allowed Sheffield United to score because it was such a blatant goal?
No, we are living in dreamland. I think the difference here is that the ball was hammered into an empty net almost, and in the game last night, we all knew at home, most of the players knew on the pitch that there was kind of, they were sort of looking around and looking over their shoulders, and there was a few smirks and grins, but it wasn't kind of confirmed, and it wasn't, they all knew, but we are living in dreamland if we expect any of them to do that, or the manager to take that decision when there's so much at stake in these last games. So, no, that's not going to happen.
Jonathan, could the Sheffield United players have done more to take control of their situation on the pitch, or do they just have to accept that decision?
I think they have to. I mean, I think you could see Ollie Norwood speaking to Michael Oliver and imploring him to have a look at it. And it's a slightly different situation to the Leeds Villa one last year because of this trust I think people have got in the technology. So, if you sort of think it through every time you doubt the technology, you then take your matters into your own hand in terms of you know, players making decisions. I don't think that's going to work. I thought that was entirely admirable and right what Leeds United did, but this is a slightly different situation where the players have just got to trust, like Michael Oliver trusted, I suppose, that the technology was working. And as I've said, if there's one person that could have solved it was the VAR referee.
I guess it is wishful thinking. And I suppose when you're thinking back to that game at Elland Road between Leeds and Villa, it was different circumstances. Both knew that they were in the playoffs positions. So this is going to be very different for Aston Villa, who are fighting for survival. They're not going to give anything. And I guess in some ways we can obviously say this, that they won't be winning the Fair Play Award, that's for sure. But there was a particularly powerful moment pre-kickoff at Villa Park, as Matt Dickinson, who was inside the stadium for The Times, reports.
The whistle went, you know, we were expecting the sort of players to charge at each other, and instead, for 10 seconds, they took the knee. And I say it was a genuine goosebumps moment, beautifully choreographed and all the more powerful for being so unexpected. So I'd say it was worth going for that moment alone. Obviously, on top of that, we got the controversy of the goal that wasn't. Football was back, something to argue about, as usual. But say, what'll live with me is those 10 seconds at the start of the game, which were genuinely moving and I think quite a really powerful message.
So it's a powerful message, Matt Dickinson says, as players took the knee in support of the Black Lives Matter movement. How much of an impact will those pictures have around the world, Gregor, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think the whole sort of spectacle of support that that Premier League players and staff as well have shown and will show in these first 12 games is historic. To replace the names on the back of the shirt is historic. To replace the Premier League badge is historic. And that moment was a kind of, as you say, it was like it captured a moment in time. And I think it's a huge step forward for the Premier League, and it shows the kind of influence and power that players wield now. And I don't think there was any other, when the players made it clear that they wanted to do something to show their support, there was no other option. The Premier League had to agree, and I think they deserve credit for that as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And Jonathan, as Matt was telling us, it's sort of a goose pimple moment, wasn't it? And hopefully we'll send out that message that the Premier League is united in this movement.
Yeah, I think so. A message with a global reach. And
yeah.
I think what's different about this this moment in time is that we've had previous anti-racism protests that have initiatives that have been based around just symbols, you know, wearing a T-shirt or a UEFA say no to racism video or whatever it is, and that they've been great. But what's been amazing about this has not just been the gestures, and that taking the knee was an incredibly powerful gesture, but to do it in the middle, you know, in a game, to stop a game and say this is so important, we're actually stopping the game that we play to do this. That was powerful. But it's been the way that footballers have backed that up by words and by discussing racism in a way, I have to say, that's been more profound and intelligent than I think our politicians have done so. And you know, Gregor did a absolutely superb interview with Wes Morgan on this, where Wes spoke really seriously and powerfully about it. I think the Pep Guardiola spoke very, very well last night, and it's felt like football is almost, football's had the kind of discussion that I wish the rest of the world was able to have on this. And it's not just the gestures, it's the gestures combined with that make this so profound.
Well, that first game of the restart ended goalless. It was a different story at the Etihad. Manchester City were 3-0 victors at home to Arsenal. And there is only one place for us to start, and that is on David Luiz. He came on for the injured Pablo Mari after 24 minutes before making an error just before half-time, as he miskicked the ball straight into the path of Raheem Sterling for City's opener. And then he was sent off just 4 minutes into the second half after making no attempt to play the ball and bringing down Riyad Mahrez for a penalty. Luiz has now conceded penalties away at Liverpool, Chelsea and City this season, and has one red card for every 13 games he's played for Arsenal, and has given away a penalty once every 6.5 games for the Gunners as well. Oh dear, it's one of those clangers for David Luiz again. How do we sum up his performance at the Etihad, Jonathan?
Well, sometimes the Premier League's got this kind of feeling of just being a massive soap opera where everyone plays their allotted parts. And David Luiz came and played David Luiz perfectly yesterday. In fact, it was one of his virtuoso David Luiz performances. But, I mean, he's at such a strange point in his career, but it's been such a strange career. To think this is somebody who was the world's most expensive defender at one point, who's moved for £110 million worth of fees in his career, and to see him at the age of 33, having not in any way developed those bits of the game that would actually make him a real top-class player, because obviously he's got great attributes too, but just that absolute lack of learning over the entirety of a career is mind-boggling, really. And I think he's, you know, setting a record for penalties, the joint record now in a Premier League season. You know, the red cards are racking up. And it was classic David Luiz in that it was, I think, his biggest problem of all has been the inability to concentrate. You know, it's something that young defenders go through and get to grips with. And at the age of 33, he still can't concentrate properly throughout a match. So he does, you know, he does 10 great things and then he just loses it for a second. Mm. And the first goal was an example of that, just a silly bobble off his shin because he's not really in the game properly, and then getting in the wrong position and sort of the penalty was another example. And he just keeps doing it, just keeps doing it. I don't know if they've had sports psychologists to work with them. I don't know how he's tried to address it himself, but as I say, mind-boggling that over the course of a career he hasn't been able to fix it in any way.
You mentioned his age there, 33, so we may not see much more of him in the Premier League. And Gregor, you actually took to Twitter last night and wrote this: "Farewell, David Luiz, you absolute maniac of a defender." I'm guessing you think his time is up. Is that in the Premier League overall? And how would you sum up his career in England?
It's funny, the most common reply I got to that was, "Defender?"
Yeah, I saw that.
So, yeah, I think that, I don't know, part of me thinks kind of, good riddance. That, yeah, I think he's gone. And I think he was never a good enough defender. He's very strange. He's like, it's almost like he has to be accommodated in whatever team he plays in. So it's like he's a luxury defender, or he's a luxury defensive midfielder. You don't normally get luxury players in those positions. They're usually the guys who go and win the game, like a number 10 or a winger or someone. And you say, you know what, we can have him in the team because he'll win us the game. Whereas David Luiz, if you have him in the team in anything other than the kind of central in a back three or a deep lying midfielder with people with lots of legs around him, he's an absolute liability. So it really does kind of just amaze me that he's still managed to play at the top level for so long as a defender. And look, I'm not saying by any stretch, you know, people are very cruel about him, and I'm not saying he's a bum. He's won the Premier League, he's won a couple of FA Cups, he's won the Champions League, he's won trophies in France and Portugal. He's got God knows how many caps for Brazil. So he's a talented footballer, but he's almost a footballer that doesn't have a position in the structure of football as it's played. I feel that's his biggest kind of issue, along with the concentration. And I can't work out whether it is concentration or whether it's kind of he's so relaxed. It's really hard to, I don't know. And he's so well respected by teammates and well liked. But, you know, part of me thinks it'll be good to see the back of him. Another part of me kind of, as Johnny says, he's a big part of the soap opera of the Premier League, and we probably will end up missing him.
Being part of the Defenders Union, Gregor, does he give defenders a bad name?
Does he give defenders a bad name? Is that a joke question?
I thought I'd throw it in there.
Well, like, as I say, if he's someone who has to be protected, that's really, like, as I said, he's a luxury defender. So if he's playing in with two defenders either side of him, and he doesn't really have to mark anyone, he just has to kind of read the game a little bit and mop up if he can, then he gets away with it. And this is not all the time, obviously, you know, this, but it's quite often. And it's the same. It was the same midfield. He would have to be the guy who can sit and spread the ball around while other people did his running. So, yeah, he's never been a defender, and that's why I got that reply on Twitter. People were saying he is certainly not a defender. So, yeah.
After the game, Luiz admitted that his expiring contract has been occupying his mind for the last few months, but didn't want to use it as an excuse for his performance. He's not signed an extension to his one-year deal at Arsenal, meaning he will be out of contract in just 12 days' time. So, Jonathan, if his mind isn't 100% focused on the job on the pitch, should he even be in the squad?
Yeah, I mean, that's a question, I guess, for Mikel Arteta. And I suppose Arsenal as a whole surprised me in their lack of apparent mental focus and preparedness for the game. Because I know Arteta's been doing a lot of work in lockdown. He's done one-on-one sessions with players. He's had lots of Zoom meetings. And I kind of thought, in terms of knowing where his players' minds were and them getting the mental side of the game right, I thought they'd be pretty good last night, and they weren't. And David Luiz, in that interview, did seem to be... It was a funny interview, again, contradictory David Luiz's performance, because on the one hand, he seemed to be taking responsibility by saying it was my fault, not the team's. But then when pressed, he didn't really explain why, and I felt he almost threw it back onto the club or the coach by... I think what he was trying to say was, my head wasn't in the game because of my contract, therefore I shouldn't have been playing. Which isn't really the same as saying it's my fault. It's kind of saying it's the club's fault. That it left me a bit confused, but I suppose ultimately... The blow of losing Socrates was a really for an injury just before the game. I think that was a very difficult one. Then, of course, Mari being taken off so early put Arteta in a difficult position. And I think the only option he might have had would have been to put Kolasinac on and sort of rejig the defence. I don't know. We could have possibly played Tierney in the middle, where he's played a couple of times. But he just doesn't have many options, which goes back to this lopsided Arsenal squad that we've talked about for so long. But, you know, it's David Luiz. He's capable of that performance when he's got no contract situation as well. So, you know, I don't know.
Do you think, Jonathan, that Mikel Arteta should take some of the blame then for including him? Because surely he would have had some conversations, and David Luiz perhaps would have alluded to the fact that he has some issues going on behind the scenes with his contract.
Yeah, I suppose Arteta has to. I mean, it is partly his job to gauge these things. I mean, there must have been positive noises coming out of Arsenal about David Luiz, because Bakary Sagna was sort of saying a couple of days ago that he felt he's really improved under Arteta, he should get a new deal. So from within the club, there's a bit of David Luiz cheerleading and momentum, I don't know. But certainly that's one of Arteta's responsibilities, I guess, knowing if the player's ready and maybe looking at him on the bench and knowing if he's ready to put him on as well.
When it comes to contract issues, Gregor, did they weigh heavy on your mind when you're out playing on the pitch?
I mean, this is the one aspect I would have some sympathy with him about, and all the players who are, what are they out in contract, in 12 or 13 days or something? So, that I mean, I don't think he probably would have wanted to be on the pitch. I think until that's sorted, I think that would be playing on your mind. But, I mean, there's only so far we can take the sympathy, because this is nothing new from David Luiz. We've seen this countless times. But I mean, there will be players in the same boat, and I think they need to have their future sorted by the 23rd. So, one way or another, we will know what the future will be for David Luiz and a few others in the coming week.
And this situation that Arsenal find themselves in at the moment, this poor defence, another contract issue, does it just simply sum the club up, Gregor?
Yeah, I mean, They've played some nicer football at times under Arteta. They've looked better organised at times, but they've got the same kind of soft underbelly, the same headless chickens in defence, the same dearth of leaders. And, you know, Arteta has shown promise. I think we've got to give him that, but it's nothing more than that. And otherwise, very little has changed. This is who Arsenal are at the moment. And it's going to take a big overhaul for that to change.
Well, Luiz was on the pitch due to two early injuries for Arsenal, who reportedly travelled to the game to Manchester by boarding a plane at London Stansted at 5 p.m, just over 3 hours before kick-off at the Etihad. Now, Gregor, are you surprised to hear that? And do you think that could affect preparations as a player?
I was a little bit surprised, but at the same time, I mean, this is a very strange time we're living in, and I don't know what the other options are. I think clubs are trying their best to avoid going to hotels or avoid going to anywhere where they have to go to a new place that's you know, they can't entirely know how safe it is for them, and you know, in the grand scheme of things. And I don't think you can really use it as an excuse. I think it'd be a very short flight. They'll still have had a chef cooking their dinner for them, their pre-match meal. You know, I don't think, it's not like they were enduring a 5 or 6 hour bus journey like some clubs do in the lower leagues, and pitching up at the ground an hour before and having to do some stretches on the bus. So yeah, I don't think it's an excuse they can really fall back on. Really, David Luiz was the man who brought them down.
Yeah, perhaps there's no hardship really for them when you put it like that. But there was no place for Mesut Ozil in the matchday squad, a decision that Arteta said was tactical. Do you think that was a mistake, Jonathan? And where do you see Ozil's Arsenal career going if he's not involved in a game against one of the big teams in the league?
I know. I mean, you know, and let's not forget, there's now an opportunity for clubs to name 9 substitutes. So for Mesut Ozil to not even be among 9 substitutes in an Arsenal 11 in a big game says a lot about where he is in relation to the club. And Arteta was extremely terse afterwards when he was asked about it. I mean, he didn't offer an explanation. You know, there's clearly something going on. And Ozil himself has been posting today pictures of you know, on social media. He's kissing the Arsenal badge, or he's holding it up or whatever. And you know, trying to emphasise the fans his loyalty. There's a kind of echo of the situation Paul Pogba was in with Mourinho maybe at United towards the end, where you know, I think social media gives players the opportunity to always have their own followings and have their own say in sort of cryptic ways. And Pogba used that quite well, and I think Ozil uses it quite well, and he's still got a lot of Arsenal fans that are behind him and want to believe he's going to be this super player. But you know, I think Arteta is clearly an intelligent manager when it comes to team culture. Clearly learnt the importance of everyone being committed to the cause through working with Guardiola and just through his own career. And the fact that he couldn't bring himself to even include Ozil does point to something about Ozil's state of mind. And it's Arsenal have to move on from it. They have to get to a point where they've moved on from this. What that means for Ozil, I don't know. But if we're talking about soap opera, this storyline in the soap opera has dragged on and on as well. It was there under Unai Emery, and it's still there now. And for that club to move forward, they need to answer the Ozil question.
Should we talk about Manchester City then? Of course, the winners last night. They opted against playing warm-up matches in preparation for the return of the Premier League and instead played 11v11 games from their squad at the Etihad. They looked rusty to begin with, but soon hit their strides and then were just brilliant at times to watch. Are they the best equipped team in the league to play behind closed doors, do you think, Gregor?
That was the kind of thought that was racing through my head when I was watching them play, yes. because I don't know, when you take all of the, when you sort of sap all the energy from the stands and the kind of the surrounding noise and everything that's been lost from having no crowds inside the stands, what you're left with is the best technically. So you know, we spoke last week about Liverpool kind of often feeding on the noise of Anfield and the atmosphere there.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously they're going to run away with the title and it's too late, but I think City, they have the most technically complete set of players, and you know, I think they've got a real chance as well in the Champions League. I think you know you don't want to read too much into one game, but the you know, Kevin De Bruyne looked so powerful. Sterling looked right on top of his game. Mahrez, you know, they've got so many attacking options. Foden came on again, you know, Silva. I think City are going to have a really good kind of period now, and it's going to take them up to the Champions League, and they'll be a tough proposition for anyone.
Finally, on last night's action, let's hear from Henry Winter, who was at the Etihad, about the match day experience without the fans.
We arrived at the ground and Manchester City staff and stewards were very professional, very polite, but it was a soulless experience without fans. You went into a sort of one-way system, walking into the building. It was restricted where you could go to. There was hand sanitizer everywhere. We were offered face coverings and gloves for those who hadn't brought it. We had our temperature checked. And then just little things like if you wanted to use the loo, there was one particular area that you could go into, and vast sections of the urinals were taped off to allow for social distancing. Press box, only 10 of us were allowed in. The Arsenal substitutes were sitting in front of us. God knows what it did for their legs that they needed to stretch out. But it was an empty feeling. But at one point before the game, I just had a look down the concourse, and the concourse is there would normally be full of Manchester City fans getting ready, excited to see David Silva and Kevin De Bruyne, but it was empty. The concessions were shuttered up. And look, everyone understands why it had to be that way until the coronavirus is conquered. But I think what it's reminded the authorities and the broadcast and everyone really, as if we needed any reminding, that fans are absolutely vital, because it was a surreal, soulless experience.
So it was a soulless experience, as how Henry describes the game at the Etihad without the fans, which is what we expected, I suppose. But once we've completed this season, which is a needs-must situation, Jonathan, do we want to start the next one if fans aren't allowed back?
Well, I don't think we really wanted to restart this one without fans, and I just think we might be in the situation where we don't have an option. It's clear football needs to be played because of for financial reasons. The government are starting to now make the first noises about fans being allowed in by September. There are a couple of companies that are looking at ways to test people and get them in. So I do think that's an obvious step, but we might have to be prepared for a bit longer of this. And of course, the soullessness that Henry describes, we don't want to see that long term. But we might have no option.
Well, of course, in order to fill the void left by the lack of fans, TV viewers were given the option of hearing fake crowd effects on the coverage last night. And Alison Rudd has been writing in the Times today about her enjoyment of the fake crowd. I have to say, I was quite hesitant about it initially, but since hearing it more recently in the Bundesliga and of course, in the coverage on Wednesday, I enjoyed it. So did we opt for effects on or effects off, Gregor?
I went for on. I flicked over in the first half, and, you know, because I remember there was a shot in quite early on, and I think Dean Henderson palmed it away. And there was a kind of small delay, and then obviously somebody, the sound engineer, turned up the oohs. kind of, it didn't fit, you know. There were moments like that were kind of, you could tell it was artificial, but just having the sort of ambient noise throughout the kind of the majority of the game was definitely better than hearing the empty kind of echoes of the shouts and stuff if you switched over to having it without that noise on. So I went for it, and you know, as I said before, I was cynical about that in the past, but I think if it helps you just kind of focus on the football and forget the situation that we're living through at the moment just for a little while, then that's a good thing for me.
Yeah, and I think you're right. I think that's what it helps. It helps you to focus on the games. It's easy, I found before with the Bundesliga, that I could easily just trail off and get distracted by other things because it didn't feel like a real game. What about you, Jonathan? What did you opt for?
I tried both, and I went for sound in the end, and I ended up being a little bit disappointed with myself because I'd love to have been an intellectual kind of aesthete who just loves football so much that I could just focus on the fine details without worrying about the big noise. But I have to admit, it was just, I don't know, just felt a little bit more normal, a little bit better with the crowd noise. Maybe it was just that thing that it meant that you did concentrate on the game more because you weren't thinking about the quietness or the emptiness. I agree with Gregor that they need a little bit of work in terms of timing some of those noises to correspond with bits of play, but there was a bit of fun in that as well.
They had that Villa, didn't they? I'm sure I heard that at some point. I quite enjoyed that. So Gregor, we're enjoying the experience then of the fake crowd noise, but do you think the players would enjoy it then? Should it be pumped into the stadium?
I think that's an interesting question. Actually, QPR, when at my visit today, they will be. They've
really?
Lee Hughes was saying that he was a cynic as well, and then they found a company that have done it, and he says it's brilliant. And they were testing it when I was there, and it was, you know, it wasn't overwhelming. It wasn't very loud, but it was just something there in the background. And it'll be interesting to see how the players react to that. I don't think we can really know. And I'm not sure. I think having something there might make it feel like it's a little bit more real, but you know, a bit less like a reserve game. Just sort of, I don't know. I honestly wouldn't know without playing, because these aren't reserve games. These are games that have a lot riding on them, and I don't know whether you'd feel it was artificial or whether you would feel that it kind of makes it feel a little bit more like it should be.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Off Air, the podcast with Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
I go to the sink and I have some cheese.
You eat cheese in the sink?
Doesn't everybody?
Every Monday to Thursday, Jane and Fee keep the microphones on after their Times Radio show.
I think if we were to do a Mr. and Mrs.
Oh no, how would that go in the booth?
Badly. It would go very badly.
Unencumbered and off air.
Two tiny women with gobs.
Off Air, the podcast. Now available on the Times Radio app.
Okay, before we finish, we have to mention a certain Marcus Rashford. It's been quite the week for the Manchester United and England star, and he hasn't even played a game yet. During lockdown, the 22-year-old has started a charity that has raised millions to feed 400,000 children, partnered on a drive to counter homelessness, and has now convinced the government to make a U-turn on free school meals to help stop 1.3 million children going hungry this summer. It's been fantastic work by Rashford and the team behind him as well. How inspiring has Rashford's actions been, Gregor?
I mean, it's been remarkable. It's very hard to think of a footballer who's sort of enacted such tangible change for a very long time. And it's the fact that it's something that's very personal to him as well. You know, he yes. was in the shoes of the 1.3 million children reliant on school meals. That's a reality he's lived through, and obviously, he's spoken about the very many people who have helped him as he grew up. You know, whether that was coaches or teachers or, you know, his parents, his mum, and the hard work she worked very hard to provide for him, provide what she could for him. So it's the fact that it's very personal for him that makes it all the more inspiring, I think. And it's just the kind of latest example of the power that players wield now. I think they're almost their own kind of little commercial entities, and when they raise their voice about something, then it's heard. But you know, Johnny spoke about Mesut Ozil there and the fact that he can always kind of counter what Arteta's been saying with a little post on social media. So that's the other side to it. But from this point of view, if they want to do something really positive with their voice, then they have the power to now. And there's more and more footballers standing up and doing that.
I don't know what you were doing at 22, Jonathan, but I certainly wasn't in a position to be thinking about helping others as Rashford is doing. Do you think he deserves more recognition for what he's done?
Absolutely. I think he's done something. I mean, how many times can someone in a lifetime, you know, any of us do something that's going to help literally millions of people. I mean, it's incredible. And to do that at age 22, even if he hadn't been a brilliant footballer, you know, that would be a crowning achievement for him. I think Greg is right. I think it's just an example of how players are using their reach. I think I spoke earlier about how it's more than just symbols now. I think there's a new sort of wave of player activism where they're actually doing as well. You know, they're doing things that count. And it's got so much admiration for him.
Rashford's efforts in lockdown have been alongside Raheem Sterling and Jadon Sancho making a stand in support of the Black Lives Matter movement, and their England captain Harry Kane, of course, has sponsored Leighton Orient shirts to help a charity and the NHS. And then, of course, there's the collective of Premier League footballers coming together for the Players Together initiative. You've spoken there, Jonathan, about the new wave. Gregor, do you think this is a new generation of footballers, and England footballers in particular in this situation, which is a sign of things to come?
I do, yeah. I think, you know, Johnny pointed to the interview I did with Wes Morgan this week, and, you know, Wes and Troy Deeney drove the Black Lives Matter support that the players have shown this week. They drove that. You know, it was an idea that they came up with and pushed towards the Premier League, and they got the support for it. So it was an idea to a conception within a week, which is pretty remarkable. And again, what Sterling and Rashford are doing in raising the voices about things that are very personal and important to them, I think we will see more and more of that. I have one caveat. I think, you know, we all inhabit and are really absorbed by this world, by the world of football. And I'm sure listeners to this podcast are too. But, you know, I think when we've seen, Johnny pointed to this, that in the last couple of days, Matt Hancock... The health secretary called Marcus Rashford Daniel Rashford. Boris Johnson, the Prime Minister, said, you know, that he hadn't really heard anything about Rashford's campaigning until the same day he did the U-turn. Dominic Raab, Foreign Secretary, has just said recently that, you know, taking the knee feels like a symbol of subordination and subjugation, and sort of compared to something out of Game of Thrones. So there are vast swathes of the population, and it's a very polarised population just now, who are either unaware of footballers' activism or strongly opposed to it. So I think we have to remember that. You know, there's a lot of people who think that these guys shouldn't be doing what they're doing, which I can't fathom personally. But I think we should remember that it's not necessarily you know, Marcus Rashford has had a huge impact here, but there's a lot of people who think that the Black Lives Matter movement in particular is something that shouldn't be associated with football. They think it's political, and, you know, again, I disagree with that, but there are a lot of people who think that way, so we have got to remember that it's possibly not having quite the impact on the whole of the population that we think.
It's interesting you've said that, actually, because I did see on Twitter some of the reaction, and of course there was some positive reaction, but there was also, as you've just pointed out, some negativity towards it. People saying, I'm done with football, for example. And you're absolutely right, there is a polarisation of people that we're living in right now. But do you think, Jonathan, that footballers should become activists in society?
Yes. I mean, I think we need to draw a distinction. And Richard Masters, I was in on the Premier League media call this week when Richard Masters gave us all the briefing, and he was being asked about this idea of players promoting political messages and where that might lead. Now, something like Black Lives Matter, Richard Masters said this, but I completely agree with it. This is not a political message, not for me anyway. This is a human race message, and it's entirely right that if footballers, like any other members of society, see what they consider to be an affront to the human race and injustice, that they are able to use what they've got, what their tools are, to make a point about it. And I think there's an irony that at the start of lockdown, you know, players were essentially being told to stay in your box, you know, take your pay cuts and get on, you know, be ready to play and entertain the nation again. You know, that phrase was used. You know, your job's to know your place and entertain us. And I think, you know, the way football's behaved in lockdown, footballers has actually just completely shifted the paradigm. That they've led the way in many things. They've taken more responsibility than you could expect any group of young men in their 20s to or younger or slightly older to take. And rather than staying in their boxes, they've shown that they're willing to you know, push beyond their sport and try and make an impact. And I think it's right that they do so. Certainly, you know, you have to look at it on particular causes, but if we're talking about Black Lives Matter, we're talking about supporting the NHS, and we're talking about trying to feed vulnerable children or children living in poverty, then, you know, these are human things. These are things to be applauded. I know that not everybody wants it, and maybe this is going to be a divide between fans and yet another divide in our society. But for me personally, it's filled me with enormous admiration the last 2 or 3 weeks, what we've seen players do.
Absolutely. Couldn't agree more. Well, that is it for now. Many thanks to Gregor and to Jonathan as well. Remember, you can subscribe to The Times and The Sunday Times to enjoy award-winning journalism online and on your smartphone or tablet. It's just £1 a week for an 8-week trial. Search The Times subscription for more information. And we will be back with you on Monday for the very latest game podcast, looking back at a busy weekend of Premier League action.
I'm Manveen Rana from The Story, a daily news podcast from The Times. Join me and my co-host, Luke Jones, for a deep dive into the big stories and investigations. Plus, each month, William Hague hosts an agenda-setting interview with a key newsmaker or big thinker. That's The Story, The Times' daily podcast that brings you one remarkable story told in-depth. Listen every weekday on the Times Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
It's the question that's on everyone's mind. How do you live a good life? Is it about work, health, or relationships? What about happiness, meaning, and money? What really matters? And how can you dramatically improve all of these things? These are the questions we explore every week on the top-ranked podcast, Good Life Project, hosted by award-winning author and perpetual seeker, Jonathan Fields, which also happens to be me. Every week, I sit down with world-renowned researchers, experts, and scions of art and industry on the Good Life Project podcast. This week, in fact, we're sharing a fantastic conversation with the author, Elizabeth Gilbert, about a single practice that changed her life. Listen to the Good Life Project podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.